For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast, where we explore how to center our lives and our leadership in the love of God revealed in Jesus Christ.
In the midst of the disruptive cultural shockwaves of the 21st century.
Join us as we learn to take the love of God seriously as the force that holds all of us and everything together.
Good day, listener, and welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast. I am still Matt Tebbe, and if that changes, I'll let you know. This will be one of the first places I will help everybody understand why my name changed and what protection program I'm in. I'm joined by, you heard Ben Sternke's voice. Hello, Ben.
Hello. Good to see you
both. Good to see you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the both he was referring to is Christy Penley.
Hey, I'm here.
Yes, you are, Christy. What do you call that thing on your head?
It's called I've had influenza A for 3 days and I haven't showered. It's a scarf to cover my hair.
Listener, Christy is wearing not just her pink headphones, but like a full-on scarf, which is not her normal look.
Listen, I'm here. I'm sitting up and
you are,
and I'm not coughing and I'm going to upgrade from pajama pants to leggings today, guys. Which women?
That's incredible. Yeah,
you know it. If you've been sick, you know that upgrade. Yeah.
That upgrade. And I also heard you were sharing that you were going to also take a shower today. So you got big life goals, Christy.
Today it's going to. You guys have been so sick the last 3 days. Okay, we don't need to talk about that. Yeah. But we do need to talk about something that's on Matt Tebbe's mind.
There's always things on my mind. Most of them are not podcast appropriate. But this breakfast. I want to chat about breakfast because my right hand is cold and I can't get my right hand warm. And it's my
just
breakfast
your right
fault.
Hand?
Just yes,
your right.
Just my right hand.
You are so old,
my
dude.
Right hand is freezing because every day, I would say like...
I think it's old man stuff.
4 out of 7 days. You have to speak up, young man. 4 out of 7 days. I can't hear you. 4 out of 7 days of the week, I eat a smoothie. So I take frozen blueberries, frozen strawberries, a half of a banana, frozen banana, and then I have these powders, these concoctions that I pour into this thing, and I put water, and I shake it up, and I drink this smoothie slowly from like, I don't know, usually like 7:30 or 8 a.m. all the way until I just finished it. So we're recording this like at 11 a.m. Eastern. So I took like, what is that, 3 hours.
Do you hold it with your right hand?
My breakfast. Well, Christy... As a matter of fact, I do.
That's why your hand is cold, man.
Yes, and so I can't bring myself quite to wear gloves for breakfast.
I have a solution.
And
a straw. Use a straw. Then you don't even have to pick it up.
That would work. Now I feel like I need to repeat. I need to repeat high school or something. That is obviously the thing I should do.
Why don't you just eat a hot breakfast, man?
Because, okay, so my wife every day eats cereal. Every day. And my kids every day eat cereal. And they switch it up, you know. I think this
different
morning
different kinds
of
cereal?
Yeah, different brands of cereal. So, you know, they'll work through different brands of cereal. I think this morning it was Captain Crunch. Oh. What's the Captain Crunch with the berries?
Ooh, yummy is what it is.
I think that's just Captain. Isn't that just Captain Crunch? Or the only berries?
No, it's got the Captain Crunch and the berries. So there's Captain Crunch.
Crunch berries. That's Crunch berries.
Crunch berries. That's what it is. So all three of my kids this morning, all three of my kids, my wife and my two kids, all eat Crunch berries. But I can't, if I eat that much like sugar for breakfast, I become a pretty miserable human. And I get crazy hungry like at 10:30. And then like the breakfast I like, Ben knows this, I like the... eggs and bacon or like an omelet. Like if I eat that every day, forget about it. These hips will not fit in my pants. So I'm trying to eat healthy, but also some days I just eat like lunch for breakfast. Some days I'll get up at like 7 or 8 and just warm up like a big bowl of soup and eat like soup.
Okay. Okay.
So
listen, this morning,
it's complicated.
Yeah. Okay. This morning I made avocado toast with egg on it for my kids. That's what you just switch it up, man. Like one day eat a smoothie and the next day eat avocado toast with one egg. It's like healthy and hot.
My daughter loves that.
I know.
My daughter loves that. I feel like that's like a millennial meal there.
I'm so young.
Millennials get teased about their avocado toast.
What does that say about me? That's great.
Yeah.
45 is the new 21.
The new millennials? Yes. 45 is the new millennial. Although, anyway.
Yeah, Ben doesn't eat breakfast.
Well, I normally don't. This morning, I was just thinking about this because you guys were talking about breakfast. Normally, I don't. I have a cup of coffee for breakfast, and then I eat like a little quick lunch. I don't know. If I don't have a lunch to go to, I eat like a little quick lunch at 11. It's just a little bit, though, and then I go work out over the noon hour, and then I have like a workout, like smoothie thing afterwards. But this morning, I had like an eggs and bacon breakfast. Oh. So,
okay.
I don't know. I just felt like it. I was just like, I'm heating up this pan. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do eggs and bacon. It's going to be great. So,
I could eat breakfast for every meal of the day. Dinner. That's why
I have brunch. Breakfast. Yeah.
Brinner. You know, we rename it because we like it so much.
Mm-hmm. We want to just have it for other meals. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be happy to just use, I prefer lunch and dinner to breakfast.
Yeah.
And I would.
And I love, for me, I love breakfast, all breakfast foods. I can't regularly, like you, Matt, I can't regularly have like sugary stuff because a lot of that traditional breakfast food is, you know, covered in syrup, like waffles and stuff. And I love that. But I can only do that on like special occasions. I can't do it regularly because I feel bad. I feel bad in my body. Yeah. But I was thinking about crunch berries too.
Now I know. Now I want some.
And I know it, but crunch berries are this like mythical for us growing up and like on all family vacations. And now on all of our family reunion vacations, crunch berries are like, we have to buy like 18 boxes of crunch berries because we associated crunch berries with vacation because we could never have sugar cereal growing up. So I credit my parents, you know, like no sugar cereals, like we had to eat like Rice Krispies and stuff, like things like that. But on vacation, it was crunch berries. We could have crunch berries every single day. And so now we probably go through 18 boxes of crunch berries every time we go on a family vacation.
I need Paul Penley on that train because he's like anti sugar cereal for our kids. And I love it so much. Like I love sugar cereals, but I need at least say vacation.
Only on
time.
Vacation.
Yeah, let's
How
do
about
that.
On vacation?
That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. All
right. Oh, man. Mm.
Well, vacations, all bets are off.
Yeah.
I mean, vacations, I'll crumple like golden Oreos in a bowl and pour milk on them and eat them as cereal. So, like, vacation is it a thoroughly
it's
embarrassing
a time outside of time.
Gluttonous circus. But that's why I drink these healthy smoothies. I'm really excited about my smoothies. They aren't particularly tasty, but they are healthy.
Use a straw next time, man. Your hand's going to get warmed up. It's a life upgrade right here. I'm so glad we talked about it.
Yeah, it is a life upgrade. You're going to shower, and I'm going to use a straw. See, listener, this is how you improve your life with very mundane, ordinary
goodness.
Things.
This is great. This is why they tune in for life tips, life hacks.
Well, enough of life tips. We've got a great conversation to bring you today. David Kramer and Miles Warrants talking about a field guide to Christian nonviolence. Mm-hmm. This was thoroughly fun conversation. We talk a lot about nonviolence here on the podcast. Why do you think that is, Ben? Ben, why do we talk about that a lot?
Because we're so violent in our hearts, we have to do something about it.
Yes, because I am inside full of rancor and malice and rage.
I'm halfway serious about that, but I think for us it's always been something that we have to seriously consider as an implication of our discipleship to Jesus.
Yeah.
So I think it's a big deal. So.
And this conversation actually is where, this book is a great book because it takes each chapter as a different stream of nonviolence and how they all sometimes nonviolence is talked about very thinly, very caricaturedly, and this book shows the depth of the tradition. Yeah. And in this conversation, we talk about the last chapter, which is a group of people that refer to Christian nonviolence as anti-violence.
Yeah.
Which was just so provocative for me because, frankly, if we can use an analogy here, I've begun to use the word anti-racist versus just sort of non-racist, you know, because racism is not perpetuated primarily through internal feelings of prejudice, but through ways of being in the world. Systems, structures, logics, common senses that are ordered and normed by white supremacy. And so if you aren't actively opposing it, it'll have you, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that violence is similar to that, right?
Yeah.
So anyway.
Totally. Just, man, there's a lot to say there. That. Yeah. We're already at 10 minutes for this intro, so well, we probably can't get into that, but I think that really is an important conversation. Just the different posture that creates to say that I'm anti this. I'm intentional about trying to see it and resist it rather than just focused on whether or not I'm overtly sort of perpetuating something. Yeah, it's important conversations. Anyway, is that all we need to say?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
I think so.
Let's get into it.
Oh, if you, listener, it is the giving season. And if you are so inclined and you have benefited from the ministry of Gravity, would you consider partnering with us? If you would like to make a donation, you can go to gravityleadership.com/partner and check out all the info. There's a little video on that page of me. I took a little selfie video of myself.
I like it.
I don't normally like, yeah, do you like
I
it?
I do. Good, thank I watched
you.
It.
I don't normally like doing stuff like that, but I said, you know what? Sometimes millennials, these kids these days, they like to look at a video instead of just read the text that I write. So I thought I'd make them a little video. So it's for all you millennials out there. If you want to watch a video of me.
Or those who are 45 and want to be a millennial.
Yeah. Are you Gen X? Is 45 Gen X, Christy?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. All right. You know, I wasn't sure what the cutoff is. Goonies. I feel like I'm a young Gen Xer, but yeah.
I feel like if you know what Goonies is, you're a Gen Xer.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Let's get into the interview.
I know what Goonies is.
Yeah, let's do it.
Here we go.
Dr. David Kramer and Dr. Miles Wernz join us today on the Gravity Leadership Podcast. David Kramer is managing editor at the Institute of Mennonite Studies, sessional lecturer at Anabaptist Mennonite Biblical Seminary, and a teaching pastor at Keller Park Church in South Bend, Indiana. Miles Wernz is associate professor of theology and director of Baptist studies at Abilene Christian University in Abilene, Texas. He's the author or editor of several books, including Bodies of Peace. Today, they're both here chatting about their latest book with us, A Field Guide to Christian Nonviolence, Key Thinkers, Activists, and Movements for the Gospel of Peace. Miles and David, welcome to the Gravity Leadership Podcast.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, I'm excited. Listeners, we have dozens of listeners, and the astute ones will remember that we have talked about nonviolence perhaps inordinately, but it's because it's so, Ben and I at Gravity think it's just such an important topic and often misunderstood or neglected topic in Christian theology. Yes. And this book is an incredible work. The breadth of it is staggering in the way it's how readable it is and how much ground you cover in such a readable, cogent, pithy form is commendable. But first, I'd love to hear, maybe as background, you both got your doctorates from Baylor, and you tell the story a little bit in your book about how you met there. Maybe tell us about how the genesis of this book came about, and how did you guys come together and decide to write it?
Sure. Well, Miles was a few years ahead of me at Baylor. I actually was familiar with some of his writing when I started at Baylor, so I think I sought him out as sort of a slightly older mentor. We won't talk about our ages, but a few years ahead of me. And we both wrote our dissertations on pertaining to nonviolence and kind of 20th century theological movements. And throughout the course of my research, at some point I got connected to the good people at Sojourners Magazine, and they were basically looking to revisit some key thinkers in Christian nonviolence in the 20th century. And part of that had to do with kind of the sad realization that one of the major influences in the 20th century, John Howard Yoder, himself had a history of sexualized violence. And so I think the people at Sojourners, as well as Miles and I, were saying, like, okay, in light of that, where do we go from here? Is nonviolence itself a sham, or are there other figures that we can turn to? And so in conversation with the people at Sojourners, I wrote an article by the same name as our book, A Field Guide to Christian Nonviolence, and looked at eight different 20th century figures and early 21st century figures that kind of talk about nonviolence in different ways and kind of compared and contrasted some of their views. And then Miles, I think you came across that article and you kind of started the conversation about the book, right?
Yeah, no, I thought it was a great article. Dave wrote the piece for Sojourners. At that time, I was teaching at I was teaching at West Palm Beach, Florida, at Palm Beach Atlantic down there, and just was really dissatisfied with the way in which a lot of the conversations around nonviolence were occurring in more academic and popular spheres. I had been on a couple of different kind of the prototypical just war versus pacifism kinds of panels. And the thing that immediately struck me was that as someone who had written quite a bit about Christian nonviolence, I knew the ins and outs of kind of contemporary just war thought and was versed in the different objections and different kind of nuances within it. But when the just war folks would talk, it was as if the only person who had ever said anything about Christian nonviolence was the Schleitheim Confession, and then skip a couple hundred years later, and then John Howard Yoder said a few things, and then that was about it. So it was just really, like maddening, because I thought there's so much here, and there's such a diversified history, and they don't all agree with one another, and they're doing a lot of interesting things in kind of distinction from one another. And there seems to be no way for folks who don't already kind of buy into it to enter into the conversation.
Yeah.
And it just impoverishes the whole conversation when there's no kind of access points like that. So after having a couple of those incredibly frustrating experiences, I talked to David and said, man, I think we need to do this. He had already provided kind of the framework. And so from there, we began to blow it out in terms of who all needed to be in this, where do these figures seem to align with one another, where do they seem to diverge from one another, and how do we begin to make sense of this field?
So. Yeah. Yeah, I think, and you know, your book is it's not an apologetic necessarily for nonviolence, but it's more kind of filling that need that you saw for just this appreciative analysis of nonviolence, so that people could actually see what it is actually, and the diversity of thought around, you know, what nonviolence is, Christian nonviolence in terms of the thought. I wonder if you could, like, as you wrote this book and or in your experience, what sort of commitments or assumptions make Christian nonviolence persuasive to people? And then maybe on the flip side, what sort of assumptions, you know, or commitments make nonviolence unpersuasive to Christians? I don't know if there's some interesting stuff you found there in your book or not.
Yeah, I can start. I think it depends on what the starting point is for the Christian who's engaging the topic. So for some people, and this is one of the reasons why I think looking at these eight different streams is helpful, because you see that there are different kind of starting points that might be more persuasive for some than others. So we start the book with a chapter on what we call nonviolence of Christian discipleship. And I think for many of us, myself included, I think Miles, maybe both of you, like growing up in more of an evangelical context where we're all about the Bible, we're all about following Jesus. And then you're sort of hit by some of these writers who are like, hey, so have you ever thought about what Jesus actually said about violence? And kind of revisiting the Sermon on the Mount, revisiting, you know, other parts of Scripture, like Romans 12, where Paul is talking about how to respond to enemies. So I think for myself personally and others kind of coming from that background, it's just like Scripture. It's yeah, Jesus, yeah. You know, and that's kind of where the conversation starts. And of course, there's lots of interesting conversation and even debates to have about how to read Scripture. And when you're looking at Old Testament narratives and, you know, even passages in Revelation that appear violent. So it's not like Scripture is a knockdown argument for nonviolence, but that is one entry point for a lot of people. But then jumping to kind of another entry point, I think for some, they might say, yeah, following Jesus, following Scripture, that's great, but people are dying. You know, people are defenseless. And what are we going to do about that? And so I think another entry point for some is looking at forms of nonviolence that are interested in results. Mm. So they say, yes, faithfulness to Jesus is important, but what can we actually do to mitigate violence in the world, to reduce the causes that lead to war? And so we have another chapter that we call Realist Nonviolence, which is kind of taking up that question in some ways in response to Reinhold Niebuhr, the famous Christian realist who was ultimately persuaded that violence at times was necessary to stop the forces of evil in the mm-hmm. world. But we came across a number of people who were kind of persuaded by Niebuhr's approach, but not persuaded that that entailed violence. And so I think for some people who may have had that caricature of nonviolence that Miles was talking about, of, okay, the Schleitheim Confession from the Radical Reformation that has a sharp separation between church and world, and it looks like it can be kind of a holy sect that's not involved in the affairs of this world. Seeing some of these other figures who are like, no, we are political creatures to the core, and how can we use our influence and power to try to address violence?
That's helpful.
Yeah, I would echo what David said. I think that people have different kind of starting points with respect to one of the most common objections that I find is with respect to the Scripture arguments or what would you do in the case of great suffering kinds of questions. I mean, I'll add one more to that, and that is, it coming from a bit different angle, is the question of what does it mean to be a pious person in the best sense. That sometimes being virtuous means taking up the sword, not for one's own sake, but in defense of others. And so this again, it dovetails into an entire tradition that has been thinking about what is the nature of virtue and how do we become virtuous people, and what does virtue in a Christological key look like? So kind of one of the examples that we point to in here is we point to a variety of people who thought of the practice of nonviolence as schooling them in the virtues and helping them to become the kinds of people that we're meant to become, but also as nonviolence as an image of what the virtuous life looks like. Aquinas in his Summa, when he's talking about the difference between natural and supernatural virtues when it comes to courage, distinguishes between the soldier and the martyr on this point, that if you look at virtue from the kind of the traditional marks of the prudent and the courage and the temperate, that the soldier matches that to it down to the nose. But if you transpose that through the Christian virtues of faith, hope, and love, then it no longer looks like the soldier. It looks like the one who's willing to die rather than to kill. So
fascinating.
And I think for each one of those points we just made, I think the flip side is kind of the sharpest argument against it.
Exactly.
So people who might, you know, be more inclined to come at it through a scriptural lens are going to raise the questions of what about, you know, the holy wars or other passages where God seems to condone violence. Those who are coming at it from a results-based lens are going to say, well, there are just times where it seems like violence is necessary to stop an aggressor. And I think those who are coming at it from the direction of virtue might quibble with whether nonviolence is a part of the kind of pantheon
yeah,
of virtues.
The virtuous life.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And now a word from a sponsor.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
All right, let's get back into our conversation.
There's a rabbit trail where we could talk about how Scripture is used in that way as an argument mm-hmm. against nonviolence, but levirate marriage and God telling Saul he would have given him more wives if he'd been faithful are never used as an argument against one man, one woman marriage. But that's not this podcast, right? You guys have mentioned a few of these streams. Sorry, I know I just indulge. You guys are indulging me here. You mentioned a few of these streams: Christian discipleship, nonviolence as Christian virtue, realist nonviolence. But then others, just to name them: Christian mysticism, apocalyptic nonviolence, nonviolence as a political practice, and then the two that were most new to me and pretty. I think provocative for me, liberationist nonviolence and Christian anti-violence. Obviously, you guys come at this book having self-identified and been practicing and learning about nonviolence for years. Which of these streams, or maybe couple streams, are home bases for you in terms of you're most familiar with them, you're most at home in them, and then which are the ones that were most new to you or foreign to you that you had the most to learn about?
I'll go first. So home base for me, I think, like David indicated, is probably are probably twofold. One is the Christian discipleship version, and then one that has, I think, become more home base for me is the argument about the virtues. I'm working on a paper right now that kind of draws Augustine into these conversations about the nature of, like, how do you read the Sermon on the Mount? So Augustine says that, you know, the Beatitudes culminate in being willing to suffer for one's faith, right? Blessed are you who when you're persecuted for your faith. It's kind of like a ladder that you ascend. And so there's a way in which I think that's a really, I mean, there Augustine in that, in as it were, is not far from the kingdom when it comes to this question of Christian nonviolence. He just doesn't take the next steps for a variety of reasons, I think.
Yeah.
So that one, I mean, that has become, I think, home base for me in terms of thinking about what does it mean for a person to proceed into the world, that there are all sorts of ways in which things like political nonviolence can offer us a practical way forward and offer us kind of collaborative help, or things like liberationist nonviolence can offer us kind of structural analysis of how violence works. But for me, I think the virtues approach has become the most challenging in that it seems to me to be the one that I want to avoid, right? Mm-hmm. It's the work on the soul that I'd rather do something rather than confront, I think, what's going on, you know, in my own habits and my own mm-hmm. desires of my heart. Mm-hmm. What was the other half of the question?
Yeah. Well, you were really challenged by mysticism.
Yeah. The mysticism one is one that I didn't quite understand, and I think I had the most to learn about. And it was one that was pretty unfamiliar to me. Around the time that we started writing this was when I started reading Howard Thurman and some of his the folks that were later influenced by Thurman. And it, again, it kind of dovetails with this question of virtue and the prayer and becoming a virtuous person, I think, for Christian tradition are never inseparable, that these are, they are part of the same, they're part of the same pursuits.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Good. How about for you, Dave?
Yeah, I think kind of in my own development, I also would have started with Christian discipleship. As we talk about in the foreword to the book, both of us were deeply influenced by Yoder, and we don't deny that influence despite some of our growing concerns about his influence over the whole tradition. But that definitely was a starting point for me in kind of transitioning from a fairly red-blooded evangelical Republican to kind of embracing more Anabaptist theology and nonviolence as a part of that. And then in my own research at Baylor, I wrote a lot about the kind of tradition of realism. So just from the standpoint of kind of my own wheelhouse there, writing that chapter was kind of ready-made for us. and so the growth points for me probably come in the latter parts of the book. I think the chapters you identified, Matt, as kind of new and challenging were liberationist and anti-violence. Mm-hmm. And Miles could tell you, if we wanted to spill the beans about the writing process, that those took us the longest to get done. And I think part of it was just the fear and trepidation trying to write about figures that I can't even pretend to step into their shoes. And so we're trying to be faithful to these movements. You know, with liberationists, we focus primarily on Latin American liberation theology. Obviously, there's other liberationist movements, Black, feminist, and so on. But that was a whole new world for me to engage. And so just trying to write about the figures there, Romero, Camara, others, just as faithfully as I could. And then one thing we did was made sure for each chapter, because we're kind of writing about it from 30,000 feet. And there can be frustrations with, you know, kind of overview books that they just miss it on particular figures or whatever. And so we wanted to make sure that the chapters had at least been vetted by experts. And so for each chapter, we sent it out to people who were doing work in that particular area. And on the Christian anti-violence chapter, I think we had initially called that something like interpersonal nonviolence,
something like that,
something along those lines. And then we sent it to a couple of the people that we discuss in that chapter. And the feedback we got was, you've described our approach well, but we're not really sure we want to be called nonviolent per se. And so they were the ones who suggested anti-violence as a more accurate description, saying, basically, so that's talking about responses to sexualized and gender-based violence for listeners who don't have the table of contents in front of you. And so
there's very few who won't.
Their feedback was essentially like, yes, we are trying to confront violence. We are trying to reduce violence, especially sexualized and gender-based violence. However, we would not counsel someone who is experiencing that violence that they have to necessarily turn the other cheek. So we are not going to be the ones to tell them in the position of oppression that violence is completely off the table for them. And I think we find kind of a spectrum throughout the book on kind of how that would be responded to. And so even looking at Helder Camara in the liberationist chapter, he has this book called The Spiral of Violence, where he says he is committed to nonviolence, even if it means being a martyr. But he's going to tell other people in the movement for liberation, if you aren't there yet, if you're not convinced, I'm not going to kind of condemn you for feeling like you still need recourse to violence.
Yes.
Other figures we discuss in other chapters would make a much harder line on kind of the Christian eschewing all forms of violence. And so that was an interesting learning point for me.
Yeah, that is interesting. Shifting gears a little bit, you guys have alluded to a few of these stories, but We had back in 2019, we had Ron Sider on the podcast talking about his book, Nonviolent Action, which is just filled with stories of nonviolent action. Because I think one of the misapprehensions about Christian nonviolence is that it's just like you just go limp, you know, and just like you fall down and faint in the face of violence. You just do nothing, you know, or you abdicate all responsibility. And you know, like some people who would see it as a virtuous thing to stand up for the weak, you know, are like, well, that's not virtuous actually for you to do that. So I think sometimes we're plagued with this lack of imagination about what does this actually look like? You guys talk about this in the book, you know, so each chapter discusses, you know, both theology and practice, both the Christian tradition behind a particular stream, but also the practical embodiment of that stream. And so I'm wondering if you can just share with us maybe a story of nonviolence that maybe one of the ones that you share in the book that you found particularly impactful or meaningful for you personally. Because sometimes I think that just sometimes helps us to get out of this imaginative gridlock that sort of for some people it feels like Christian nonviolence is just off the table because they jump quickly to home invasion or Hitler. And they were like, well, what else are you going to do? You got to bomb Hitler. You got to like kill the home invader, you know, and then the discussion is over. So I don't know. Can you share a couple stories that you found meaningful? Or
I mean, I can start with one that might be more familiar and kind of show how, and just see how that show one that kind of pushes the edges of that. So I think most of the audience will be familiar with the witness of Martin Luther King Jr., right? Yeah. So one of the things about his approach that we discuss in his chapter is the way in which nonviolent practice was not designed to be passive, but was designed to heighten tension. It was designed to provoke, to put the issue front and center. Yeah. Right, we're not going to be quiet about this. We're going to peaceably make our voices known in the way that's going to create disruption. Right. Mm-hmm. We're not going to just kind of let it sit to the side.
Yeah.
So there is a chapter that we deal with what's called apocalyptic nonviolence, which takes some of those insights and pushes them even further. So in the 1970s, in the height of Vietnam, you have a group of Catholic priests and others. If you know the names of Daniel and Philip Berrigan, or William Stringfellow, like these were all kind of names associated with this movement, that they break into a draft office in Catonsville, Maryland, and they steal a bunch of draft cards, and they take homemade napalm and set it all on fire in the parking lot of the draft office. So the reason that they do this is to dramatically highlight what death is doing. Mm. And so they take that instinct of that nonviolence is supposed to be something which confronts and something which agitates, and they push it. They push the envelope on that by saying, "Okay, so if that's part of what nonviolence is to do, then the extension of that is that nonviolence should be actively opposed to those things which are causing death, right? So that it is permissible from an apocalyptic standpoint to do things like break into the draft office and set fire to the stuff that's actually facilitating war.
Right.
Or it begs the, we did an interview for Sojourners in which they asked, I think Mitchell asked the question, so does that mean that it would, from a nonviolent perspective, it would be acceptable to like blow up a pipeline if it's if it's creating death and destruction for like a community? And I had to say, well, I think from an apocalyptic perspective, probably, yeah, they would want to just draw a distinction between those things which are causing death. Right. Like, you're not killing people, but you're actively opposing all those things which are creating death in the world.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So
there was
heightening that tension to the point of destroying those things which are doing the death.
So, right. So Miles, as you're talking, I'm thinking of this video I watched on the web of a farmer whose groundwater had been contaminated by fracking. Mm-hmm. And he went before the either town legislature or the state legislature and brought water from his farm and went around as he was speaking to every representative there who had a glass of water and dumped their water out and poured some of the water in that was, I mean, it was like cloudy, nasty water and told them, you know, if there's nothing to do about this, then go ahead and drink the water on my farm. And it's like this direct confrontation of like what's dealing death to creation. And the people who are responsible or could be responsible for it, you're making it so that it's really hard for them to ignore what you're doing.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You have to, it's right in front of you. You're confronting the agent of that, of that violence.
Yeah.
And so,
It's almost like, parenthetically, David, I want to hear if you have a story as well, but parenthetically, it's almost like it's a marketing issue. Like nonviolence seems to indicate not something, right? It's like, I'm just sitting at home. I'm not being violent. You know, I'm not doing anything. But I think, you know, all these stories are like, these are filled with action. These are filled with confrontation. These are filled with tension, you know, like, and it's sometimes filled with like crime, you know, like people doing things that are technically illegal. But for the sake of, you know, liberation, for the sake of creation, for the sake of goodness, in the world. So anyway,
And of course, there's,
maybe we got a branding problem.
Well, of course there's these, you know, that's why anti-violence is such a provocative word.
Yeah, that is interesting.
I think, because it opens up new possibilities. But I'm thinking of like even the Hebrew midwives, you know, who get praised for lying. Because they lie in order to, lying is a violence of truth, but they're keeping people alive, you know, and how you mentioned earlier, turning the other cheek, like most of us have this intuition that that's an awful thing to say to a domestic violence survivor, right? Like because we know that there's power at work there that undoes actually what's happening in Jesus's turning the other, like there's something going on of powers at work in a way that changes what that symbolizes and does. And so there's like this dual thing of we don't have a way to see how power works, so it's okay for a Hebrew midwife to lie in order to not kill a kid, and that's different than just lying in another context to get something that you want. And how these direct actions mean different things depending upon who's doing them and when, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I like that you invoked Ron Sider, because the subtitle to that book, Nonviolent Action, is What Christian Ethics Demands But Most Christians Have Never Really Tried.
Yes, so good.
And I think that's why he gives all those stories to say, hey, if you just give it a try, you know, that's part of the marketing aspect. Like, let's see if it's going to work. And I think sometimes the metrics for success differ between wars and nonviolent action. So, you know, not to get too political, but we spend, you know, two decades involved in these sprawling wars that cost countless lives, billions of dollars. And, you know, there's still people debating whether those were successful or not.
Right.
But then a nonviolent approach might be kind of unsuccessful by some metrics, but it doesn't cause the same amount of death and destruction.
Right.
So.
But then it invalidates, you know, the whole approach, you know, when we're not necessarily opposed to all wars because, you know, Afghanistan went terribly or something. Hmm. Anyway.
Right. But I think it was maybe in 1983-84 at this Mennonite World Convention gathering of Mennonites from all around the world where Ron Sider spoke. And his speech basically said, what if we were as committed and serious about nonviolent action as our governments are about violent action? And so it's just this call to like, let's put our feet where our mouth is, as it were, and out of that develop Christian peacemaker teams. So if your listeners haven't heard of that, they're now called community peacemaker teams because it's expanded beyond just those who are committed to
Christians to fill the teams, so they had to.
Well, I'd like to think of it as the Christian witness went forth and drew others in. So, yeah, their kind of motto is we get in the way. You know, they go to places where conflict is happening and just try to be a witness to it, try to use their kind of power to leverage you know, through media and different things. And it has been costly. So there was a young 20-something-year-old Mennonite from right around my area, MJ Sharp, who lost his life in one of these engagements a few years ago. So, yeah, I'd look up Christian peacemaker teams or community peacemaker teams. And then another really compelling story. If you haven't seen the documentary Pray the Devil Back to Hell, this is about the movement to end the civil war in Liberia. And it was basically a bunch of Christian women got together with a bunch of Muslim women and said, this is crazy. Like, our sons, our husbands should not be killing each other. And so through all kinds of nonviolent protest and activity, they were basically able to bring the civil war to a halt. Wow. And so there's a documentary that came out of that, Pray the Devil Back to Hell, that I would encourage you to take a look at. It's really, yeah, moving.
Quite a provocative title.
Yeah.
I like it.
We'll be right back.
The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, our 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn how to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life that God shares with us. It is a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying out some new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us toward holistic flourishing, more transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people from all over the world in this formation framework, and it's helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives and learn to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. This is something I just thought of, and I wonder if you guys could place this in a stream, or I know that some kind of practices or habits of nonviolence maybe incorporate one or more streams, but a friend of mine recently told me a story. She lives in a predominantly black neighborhood. She's a black woman, and she saw some young teenagers, underage teenagers, out under a street lamp after dark drinking, and they were getting like louder and more inebriated, and she knew like, this is going to end badly for these teenagers, right? And so she called up another mom. Neither of them were moms of the kids out there. And she went outside, she said, in her pajamas without a bra on and put on some loud music. And her and this other mom started dancing right next to these boys. And the boys like laughed and catcalled for a bit. And then the moms got more and more sort of like audacious and goofy and whatever. And what happened was, and this is why they did it, what happened was the boys finally decided to move on, to leave, because the energy they had created there was changed because these two middle-aged moms were dancing in their pajamas. And she said, I did this because I knew that if I didn't do it, it was a matter of time before the police were called. And if the police were called, it would not end well for these boys. And so she sort of directly confronted maybe what she saw as something that would cause more harm than what was happening and ameliorated it or dissipated it. And I like to think of that as like a direct action that is not using violence to find its telos. And I wonder how, through the streams in your book, how do you understand what's going on there?
Yeah, that's an interesting example. I'm not sure it maps on perfectly with any one stream. I mean, it reminds me in some ways of various forms of nonviolence as political practice, you know, tracing its lineage from King back to Gandhi. And one of the reviewers of our book basically was concerned that we were opening up too many forms of nonviolence. And he wanted to say like, no, nonviolence is that active creative force. Like that is his definition. And I think the story you just gave there is of nonviolence as creativity and as action to kind of create a new alternative. So I don't know if it necessarily would be considered political practice, although if they're thinking of it in terms of them engaging so that the police don't engage, it could kind of fall in that category for sure. But I think viewing nonviolence as an active creative force in the world versus sort of a passive, inactive kind of stance, I think is a yeah, it's a really helpful way to think about
yeah,
it.
Yeah, I agree.
Miles, what do you think?
I was gonna say that as well. I think that really illustrates I think some of the creative practice that you find in that chapter. So one of the things you mentioned, Matt, is the way in which some of these figures kind of overlap and they kind of mix the streams, as it were. So Dorothy Day, we place in the virtue chapter because I think that fits most with her approach. But she was also involved in a lot of kind of these direct action sorts of things as well. Was arrested multiple times for mm-hmm. violating like air raid drills that they would go out into the street just to kind of demonstrate against the civic practice that was going. So again, kind of a there's one form that everyone is expected to take, and so nonviolence takes a more creative form in order to draw attention to the problem and to create a different way forward. So,
yeah.
Well, and another interesting thing about that story is I don't know these women, but it's possible they weren't pacifists.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, I think it's helpful to recognize as we're looking at Christian nonviolence that you can engage in forms of Christian nonviolence without being a convinced card-carrying
yes.
pacifist.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And I think sometimes it becomes such an either or that it's like, okay, if I believe that there is right. room for violence in some, you know, circumstance, that I can't be committed to nonviolence. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's necessarily the case.
Yeah.
I think we can have those intramural debates mm-hmm. among, you know, faithful Christians about sort of those, you know, maybe it's about war, maybe it's about police action, maybe it's about, mm-hmm. you know, self-defense or whatever. But those debates shouldn't stop us from coming together and working toward a less violent
yeah,
world.
And I think this is where the phrase anti-violence provoked me to think of this story, because I'm with you, Dave. I mean, she's a friend of mine. We haven't had, are you a committed nonviolent person? But the thing is, she was anti-police violence
mm-hmm.
in that situation mm-hmm. and knew mm-hmm. that the only thing I have to prevent this is me being weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
That's right.
And,
yeah. That's right.
And that is such a unique energy to bring in a situation where we're reduced down to binaries of do nothing or call the police.
Right.
You know?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
This is why I think, guys, this book is so helpful. There's so many people, faithful Christians throughout history that you tell their story and also connect these streams together, and it opens up new possibilities for us. I mean, I was just thinking here, I don't know if this occurred to you guys, but you have the nonviolent virtue kind of chapter, and then you have the violence against gender and sexualities chapter, and the word virtue, vir, is man, right?
Uh-huh.
So this yep. this concept mm-hmm. even of virtue is shaped by manliness in a Roman mind. And what
right.
would somebody who's really dialed into gender violence have to say about virtue? I don't know if did that show up at all for you guys? Was that on your radar? Did anybody give you feedback on that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. There would be the interesting thing about this book is, you know, we aren't picking winners or losers, but there would be some people that we talk about in some of these chapters who would be adamantly mm-hmm. opposed to people we talk about in other chapters.
Yes. Yeah.
And so we, you know, maybe don't always draw out those sharper edges as much, but there would definitely be, and I don't want to name names, but if you want to do some homework on some of the people we discuss, mm-hmm. there would definitely be some figures who would be at loggerheads with
yes,
each other.
I think that's right.
Yeah. Well, as we're winding down here, maybe Dave and Miles, I think listeners can intuit and maybe infer from the things you've said what you hope they get out of this book, more deeper appreciation for the diversity of nonviolence, a better, maybe more creative imagination for how to inhabit and embody that. Maybe as we close here, how do you take this work? In what ways are you extending it? So are you working on things that are related to this now? What sort of projects do you feel like could spring from what you introduced here?
Mm. David, what about you?
Well, I wear a couple different hats. I'm a pastor in a urban neighborhood here in South Bend, Indiana. So some of the ways I extend this is just in my own pastoral practice, when it's providing pastoral counsel to victims or survivors of domestic violence. You know, I've had situations where someone might have never been told by a pastor that it's actually okay to leave that situation. And so having done this work and being able to say that with some amount of confidence, I think is somewhat liberating to people who are in those situations. And then my work at the seminary often includes editing other people's work. And so I'm going to put a little plug in for a brand new book called Resistance, which is a collection of essays by, mostly by and for Anabaptist or Peace Church people. But the editors titled it Resistance, which I think is a pretty clear call to a shift away from non-resistance to resistance. And a lot of it's focusing again on resistance to sexualized violence in the church. So yeah, those are a couple areas that I'm kind of continuing this work. Yeah.
How about for you, Miles?
I've got a couple of writing projects that I think will continue to tease out some of the edges. I've got a piece that's going to come out in Christian Century later this fall, kind of talking about the relationship, some of the things we talk about in the book, like the relationship between the ordinary violence that you find highlighted in figures like Romero, and drawing the connection between ordinary violence and the more spectacular forms of warfare, that one breeds another, right? Yeah. That when you become very comfortable with ordinary violence, then things like international conflict don't become out of the realm of possibility. We become much more able to imagine them and to reach for them. One of the figures that nags me the most is Dorothy Day. And so I've written a bunch about her, just some academic and some popular writing, but I'm working on a book long-term that's going to take her work and put it into conversation with a lot of contemporary Christian ethics. So that's down the line for me so those are just like some writing things on a popular, unlike on a practical level. I think one of the things that I do work with is, in my world, women's ordination is not practiced often. It's not frequent. There's an organization called Baptist Women in Ministry that I'm on the board of. And so trying to find ways to advocate more directly and strongly for women's ordination in my neck of the woods, I take that to be an extension of this kind of work.
Sure. Great. So.
Great. The book, again, is called A Field Guide to Christian Nonviolence, Key Thinkers, Activists, and Movements for the Gospel of Peace. Miles and David, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Christy, what's a three-letter word that starts with gas?
A three-letter word that starts with gas?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. What is it?
Car.
Oh, my gosh.
I was going to say gas.
Yeah,
I was right? You ran out of letters after you got gas. You ran out of letters. So.
It's a car. Car goes with gas.
Car goes with gas.
Well, yeah. Listeners.
That's like my recent joke. I actually don't know when I told that joke. Did I tell you guys the joke about the cargo?
Oh, yes.
Cargo space?
Oh, yes.
Last time.
Oh, yes.
Was that last time? All right. Well, listener, I hope you've heard that joke, because that was one of my favorites. I think about it once a week
still
now.
Still chuckling.
And I just chuckle about it. Cargo can do that. Cargo road.
Oh, my goodness.
Y'all. All right, listen.
All right. See you next time.
Have a good day.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Leadership Podcast. If you're finding it helpful or enjoyable, we'd love it if you'd tell your friends about it.
Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And you can join our Gravity community online for free at gravityleadership.com/join.
You'll get our latest content delivered straight to your inbox, as well as our email most Fridays with curated links to articles we find interesting and helpful. To join us, go to gravityleadership.com/join.
Our podcast is produced by Ben Sternke and Matt Tebbe. Aaron Sternke edits and mixes the show. You can check out his work at aaronsternke.com.
We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or comment for us, go to gravityleadership.com/message and click the Start Recording button.
You can also email us at podcast@gravityleadership.com. Catch you next time.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.